From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And this morning, our first guest is author Ryan Emanuel. Emanuel is an environmental scientist and a member of the Lumbee tribe. His book is called On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, which includes stories from North Carolina about indigenous survival and resilience in the face of radical environmental changes.
Then in the second half of the show, we are joined by Kate Ireland, Director of Youth Engagement at the Nature Conservancy, and Lena Gomez, Vice President of Strategic Innovation and Youth Initiatives for National Geographic. The two organizations have collaborated on a program involving externships, a unique way of engaging the next generation of environmentally conscious youth on local environmental issues and solutions. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us. Welcome back to This Green Earth. And joining us as our first guest is Ryan Emanuel. He's an environmental scientist, a member of the Lumbee tribe in North Carolina, and most importantly, the author of the new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Thanks, Chris and Claire. I'm happy to be here with you.
Well, let's start here. Tell us a little bit about yourself. I mentioned, alluded to your environmental scientist, but I'm sure you're much more. Spend a minute or two telling us about yourself.
Sure. I span what sometimes people call Western sciences, so environmental sciences and specifically water science. But as a Lumbee person, I also am immersed in our values around water and the environment as well. So the work that I do today draws from both of those ways of exploring and investigating and asking and answering questions about the world. And I draw from both of those traditions in my work and in my book as well.
All right. Now give us a little background on the Lumbee tribe. It's a fascinating background in history. But for those of us out here in Utah, maybe not be familiar with it, share that with us.
Absolutely. So we are indigenous peoples of the southeastern United States. Our people descend from the survivors of the first waves of colonization, which go back to the 1500s. Mm. So we've been exposed to centuries of colonial violence, war, disease, etc. So our encounters with settlers, with discrimination, with oppression, look very different than in other places in North America and other parts of the world. Our ancestors found refuge in these vast wetlands in the coastal plain of what is now North and South Carolina and parts of Virginia. We coalesced into new communities during the colonial period. Those communities persisted for centuries. And you know, today we are Lumbee people. We were actually recognized by federal law in the 1950s that simultaneously denied us a government-to-government relationship with the United States. And so we're the only tribe in the U.S. that exists in this state of what some people describe as legal limbo. Hmm. We're one of the 10 largest American Indian tribes in the United States and the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River. We have about 60,000 enrolled tribal members, most of whom live in a four-county area in southeastern North Carolina.
As you said, you've been around for centuries, plus or minus. Just curious, what role did the Lumbee tribe play in the Civil War? Were they sympathizers of the Confederates or conscripted into the army? Do you have any insight in that? I know that's a bit of an aside, but I'm just always curious about that.
Yeah, so the really fascinating story. Our ancestors were pressed into service for the Confederacy, but not military service. We were forced to construct fortifications along the Atlantic coast in these very swampy, hot, humid environments where Enslaved people were actually not allowed to work because the slave owners did not want their quote unquote property exposed to those harsh conditions. So they pressed Lumbees and other what at the time were called free people of color to build these massive earthworks down at the coast. And during that time, we had a lot of young men who resisted and ended up hiding out in the swamps. One of those young men, Henry Barry Lowry, became the leader of a group of guerrillas who fought a years-long war against the Confederate Home Guard. These were the Confederate soldiers that sort of stayed on the home front during the war to keep tabs on what was going on locally. And then after the Civil War, they continued their guerrilla war against local officials who were, you know, nominally back in the United States, but they were really the same people, just wearing different hats. And Henry Barry Lowry, this leader of the band, ended up disappearing in the early 1870s without a trace. And so he is revered among Lumbee people and among some of our neighbors as a hero, because he was a freedom fighter during the Civil War era. You could think of him as a Robin Hood figure, but a true life Robin Hood.
Right. And I'm assuming then that post-Civil War or Reconstruction, that he had to take up arms against the Klan.
Yes. So in the era of the Ku Klux Klan, you know, we were targeted, as were other racially marginalized groups in the South. And it was actually the mid-20th century when we had our best-known encounter with the Ku Klux Klan. In 1958, the Klan decided to have a rally and a public cross-burning in our territory, and they foolishly announced publicly that they were going to hold this rally. They rented a field and gathered about 50 Klansmen, and some of them brought their families to this rented field one night in January in 1958. And as they started up their generator to power their PA system and light bulb for their rally, about 500 armed Lumbees and their allies stepped out of the dark swamps, surrounded them, shot out the lights, and in the darkness there was mayhem, and the Klan was routed from the field and from Robeson County. That's the principal county where we live. The Klan leader was captured after hiding out in the swamps for 2 days. He was arrested, and he was convicted of inciting a riot and served time in prison. And that was the last time that the Klan publicly revealed themselves in Robeson County.
Wow.
Wow. So clearly you have deep roots in this history.
Deep pride, you have integrity.
A wealth of knowledge around the Lumbee tribe. And as part of being a part of this tribe, and you had spoken to your love of water, and what have you brought from this kind of maybe ancestral love of the land and water into your work as a scientist now? You've moved into this career that revolves around land and water.
Yeah, so, you know, my academic training, I had a very reductionist approach to water. You know, water was a substance that we could measure and characterize and quantify and break down into constituent parts and look at things that were dissolved in or carried by the water. And that's fine, and that's important. And we need to ask those types of questions in order to ensure that water supplies are healthy for people and for our non-human relatives. But what I found was missing was values associated with water that connected to places like Lumbee territory that are really defined by waterscapes. These vast wetlands with towering bald cypress trees, dark water. So our water here is naturally brown tinted because of all of the organic matter decaying in the soils. The water that you see in our rivers and streams is basically tea because it's steeped in organic matter before it reaches
tannins, tannic.
Exactly. And so it's this beautiful color, but all of these elements come together to really create a special culturally significant landscape that we don't really talk about as water scientists, but I thought it was very important to elevate these aspects of water into conversations about what we value when it comes to water and to the environment, and more importantly, how we make decisions about the future of rivers, streams, and other kinds of waterscapes. And so really, I saw an opportunity to bring what I saw as a cultural value associated with water into spaces where people are talking about environmental policies and environmental permitting, but typically doing it from a very quantitative approach.
We're speaking with Ryan Emanuel. He is an environmental scientist, member of the Lumbee tribe, located in southeast part of North Carolina. And we're talking about his new book, On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. So water is a foundational element of the Lumbee tribe culture. I believe, does the Lumber River actually run through your tribal boundaries?
It is, yeah. Our tribal territory is virtually defined by the watershed of the Lumber or the Lumbee River. So several years ago, our tribal council passed a resolution calling on everyone to refer to this river by the name Lumbee, which is what we call ourselves and what we call the river as well.
Okay. So let's focus on then some of the, or talk about some of the environmental challenges associated that the Lumbees face, say with respect to water quality, water volume or so. What are some of the challenges?
Yeah, so one of the major water quality challenges that we face has to do with industrialized livestock production. In North Carolina, is a hotspot for swine and poultry production at very large scale. We're not talking about backyard farms and family farms. We're talking about large industrialized operations, similar to the types of feedlots that you may have across Western states. But these are places that pack cities worth of swine and poultry into relatively small buildings. And then the water quality issue has to do with how we dispose of that waste. And there are various ways of distributing that animal waste across the landscape. Unfortunately, most of those methods end up filling waterways with nutrients, and in some cases, pathogens, harmful bacteria, viruses, and so forth. And so this is something that we deal with. It's a pressure that's been steadily growing in my lifetime. These facilities are not that old. They've only been around since the 1980s. So I distinctly remember a North Carolina without these types of industrial facilities. And I remember what our waterways were like before we had all of this waste disposed of on the landscape. So that's one of the major water quality challenges that we face. We also face fragmentation of these beautiful wetlands by all types of infrastructure development, but in particular, natural gas transmission pipelines. As southeastern states are turning away from coal for electricity, as they should, instead of turning to renewables, unfortunately, though, they're turning to shale gas and other kinds of fossil fuels. And in order to do that, they need to crisscross the landscape with very large transmission pipelines. And that often requires cutting through and fragmenting these beautiful wetland forests for pipeline rights of ways and easements and things like that. And then a third challenge that we face has to do with climate change. In the southeastern U.S., climate change looks like extremes becoming more extreme, droughts becoming drier, tropical storms and hurricanes bringing more water and therefore bringing more floods.
Right.
So we're seeing more extreme flooding and more extreme drought at the same time. And those wild swings on our river really lead to unhealthy conditions for aquatic ecosystems, wildlife, and things like this. And of course, the associated problems for humans who rely on that water for water supply, or who live close to the river and may be threatened by flooding.
Yeah, I recall, might be a few years ago, a hurricane or strong tropical system that came up along the North Carolina coastal plain, Wilmington area or so. And you had several things. First, you had physical flooding, so high water, but then all the local hog farms were flooded, and then all that wastewater and matter gets released into the environment in general, not just the river, but everywhere across the landscape. Having worked in the wastewater treatment field, I know that hog farms and hog waste is some of the most, I'll say, intense wastewater that you can imagine, levels of fecal coliform and other types of bacteria and viruses and stuff. And like you say, Ryan, put it on an industrial level, you have a real risk of contaminating riverways, water bodies, et cetera. So, it's a real challenge in those industrial size hog farms and poultry farms, et cetera. You say gas pipelines. Is there an active fracking that goes on in North Carolina, a gas extraction industry, or is that just transmission lines that are running through your land?
We are not a site of gas extraction.
Okay.
Thankfully, we are a site of gas transmission. So we lie in between fracking areas of the Appalachians mm-hmm. and population centers on the coast, where gas-fired power plants are being built today. And so because of our location in between those two regions, and because of historical decisions about where to locate transmission pipelines back in the 1950s and so forth,
wow.
we bear the brunt of the expansion of that transmission network today.
And I have heard you refer to these areas in which this industrial, these things are happening as sacrifice zones. Can you explain that?
Mm.
Yeah, so this is the idea that collectively some places can basically be dumping areas for either waste or unwanted infrastructure. And unfortunately, we have a long history of declaring that these sacrifice zones are going to be in marginalized communities or communities that don't typically have a seat at decision-making tables. And it's very easy to other those communities and to saddle them with more and more waste, more hazardous or polluting infrastructure, and so on. And so, yeah, as much as I love our home and our territory, I do acknowledge that for all practical purposes, this territory is being sacrificed for the convenience of cheap meat and continued use of fossil fuels.
So when these conversations start and you're coming in as a scientist, but also a person who wants to bring the indigenous perspective into the foreground, what does that path then look like? What are you wanting to see in the future?
That is a great question. And so one of the things that I do to frame this conversation is I point to environmental justice policies. These are policies that say we should not create these disproportionate burdens on marginalized communities. And so I really put the question back on our decision makers and say, this is what we've done for decades, if not centuries. Do we really want to continue this pattern of disproportionate impacts on people who, in many cases, have contributed least to the consumption or to the use of energy or things like this? And so I try to use the tools and techniques from my training as a scientist. In other words, I can compute things like demographic disparities when it comes to who lives in the sacrifice zone, right? Or, you know, what are the spatial distributions of this kind of infrastructure? And then I try to pair that with the values that Lumbee and other indigenous peoples have about the places that they love. You know, these are not wastelands. These are people's ancestral homelands. And so I try to raise awareness of this and get our decision makers to think critically about the choices that they're making about whether and where to put this infrastructure.
Are you finding support from, say, local politicians or even state level politicians, representatives like that, or federal organizations, Bureau of Indian Affairs, et cetera?
It varies. Yeah. There are a lot of well-intentioned people who occupy these positions of decision-making authority, but they're also part of institutions that carry a lot of inertia, and it's hard to translate goodwill into actual policy changes, right? When you've got a 50-year history of building pipelines along a certain corridor, it's really hard to change that from an institutional perspective. But I think it's important to keep pointing out what we're doing and make sure that if we are going to continue doing this collectively as a society, we at least understand the ramifications of what we're doing.
I have to say, I found it interesting that, or at least this is what I read, that then-President Trump visited the tribe back in 2020 when running for re-election. And he actually, again, this is what I read, he actually won that Robeson County or your geographical area. Just wanted to point that out. I don't know if you have anything to supplement that.
Yeah. Well, one thing I'll point out is that Lumbee people, unfortunately, do not have high voter turnout rates. So, you know, we did see Donald Trump carry Robeson County in the 2020 election. But, you know, indigenous people are only a small portion of the actual electorate during that election. It doesn't mean that we don't have a lot of people who supported him in that election.
Right.
Their support for him went back way before he made any campaign stops. Hmm. I think that, you know, there's a strong populist streak in our community.
Right.
And I think that he was able to capitalize on that. It's not fair or accurate to say that Lumbee people supported him because he said that he would support, you know, amending our Recognition Act from the 1950s.
Right.
And I say that because every politician comes and says that to us.
Yes.
So Lumbee people are very savvy when it comes to sort of sussing out these claims that politicians make. So that was not unusual. Biden made the exact same claim during the campaign as well.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I just wanted to clarify that. And who knows who might visit over these next several months or so. Last question or so, last couple of minutes. Again, explain, where does the tribe stand with respect to federal recognition?
The tribe has been attempting since the 1970s to have this act from the 1950s amended. There's a clause at the end of that law that states, you know, our prohibition from having a government-to-government relationship with the U.S. And since 1973 or 1974, there's been a bill introduced in almost every session of Congress to remove that clause and amend the act. Hmm. Unfortunately, because of our size, we're perceived as an economic threat on a system that is already strained when it comes to serving indigenous peoples in the United States. And for that reason, Lumbee people have seen a lot of political pressure and even lobbying against us in Washington to persuade legislators not to amend that act. And while the House of Representatives has passed an amendment bill six or eight times.
Yeah.
The Senate has never actually voted on it.
That's interesting. And again, by size, you mean you're too large.
We're large. Yeah. If we were a tribe of 1,500 people, this would not be an issue.
Right.
And in fact, Congress has gone back and reinstated recognition for previously recognized tribes that were terminated during the same era that our law was passed. And by and large, those were smaller tribes. I think the difference for us is our size. You know, 60,000 people, one of the 10 largest tribes in the U.S. That's perceived to be a burden on, you know, what I acknowledge is a strained system.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, we do have to wrap up because of our time constraints. Ryan, can you tell us in your book on the swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice, what is maybe one of the biggest takeaways that you would like a reader to have?
I want non-Indigenous readers to understand that we're not a monolith in the way that Indigenous peoples experience the environment in a traditional way and in a 21st century way, in the way that we have to engage with colonial governments, state and federal governments, and so forth. And because we're not a monolith, places like the Southeast look very different from what stereotypical notions of Indigenous connections to place may look like, right? I don't want to romanticize it. I don't want to mythologize it. I want to show what our relationships look like, for better or for worse, given our long history of colonialism. And so it's a very scrappy and very unexpected story about our relationships to this beautiful place here in the swamps of what's now North Carolina, but has always been our home. Mm. And so I hope people will take away from that the truly unique relationship that we have. And we are Indigenous peoples, and we do have this incredible long-term relationship to place.
Right.
It may not look like the relationships that Indigenous peoples have to the places that they come from in the Pacific Northwest, in the Southwest, in the Rocky Mountains, right, et cetera. That doesn't make us any less Indigenous. And I think it's important for people to understand the diversity of Indigenous experiences across the United States.
The name of the book is On the Swamp, Fighting for Indigenous Environmental Justice. The author is Ryan Emanuel. Ryan, website that people can go to learn more about the book and your other work?
RyanEmanuel.com.
Ryan, again, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Yeah, we appreciate you being with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. And today, our second guests are, this is exciting, Chris, because it's the first time I've ever heard a term called externships. Maybe you've heard this before, our mm-hmm. listeners have, but this is really exciting to talk about. We have Kate Ireland, who is the Director of Youth Engagement at the Nature Conservancy, mm-hmm. and also Lena Gomez, who is the Vice President of Strategic Innovation and Youth Initiatives for National Geographic, and they are here to talk about externships. Now, I know we've all heard the term internship, but this is something special that they have partnered to do to help today's youth as they're inheriting a lot of things that are happening around our globe due right. to environmental changes. They are allowing them to step into a space where they get to take an active lead in our planet. Mm-hmm. So why don't we start with you, Kate, and tell us about the externship and how you ended up partnering with National Geographic to do this.
Yeah, absolutely. So we started this work back in 2021. We were really interested to think together about what it would be to bring our organizations together to really invest in global youth and create more opportunity for them. We are two of the largest nonprofits globally. We know we have a big footprint, and we see alongside that a real responsibility to think about how we are engaging young people, how we are arming them with the tools that they need and the experiences that they need to be able to really lead as it comes to conservation, as it comes to nature. So we actually, at the behest of our CEOs on both ends, we started to really think about what that could look like to jointly work together. And we landed on starting to develop something that would create more accessible pathways to leadership opportunities, to career opportunities, which is for us an externship. So when we think about traditional career experiences, there are so many valuable pieces to something like an internship, a fellowship, some of those more traditional pieces, but there are also some barriers when we think about them. So often if, for example, you are working in an internship, you may need to be in an established higher education pathway. You may need an ability to travel, to work for reduced or no pay, and then barriers that we may not see, whether that's a lack of sense of belonging due to identity, gender, race, physical limitations, different cultural considerations. So the externship was for us an opportunity to develop something that removed those barriers, that was flexible, that was scalable, that allowed young people to apply learnings and leadership within their own communities. Yeah, we've been really thrilled by what has happened since we launched that in 2021.
And Lena, share with us some of these projects that are being worked on, or tell us a little bit more about how this externship works.
Yeah, thank you so much. So an externship, one of the reasons why we really are aiming to tackle some of those barriers is that it is a virtual program that really takes our externs through about 8 weeks of learning together. It's a combination of synchronous and asynchronous learning. And because you've got really National Geographic and the Nature Conservancy coming together, what's great is that you actually, our externs are able to learn both from National Geographic explorers and experts, as well as experts from the Nature Conservancy. So you're really bringing two powerhouses together to really bring topics around marine and community conservation and freshwater and community conservation. And it really makes a great introduction to those careers, as well as you're able to cover things like research, primary and secondary research, the ability and learning how to speak with local leaders, conservationists, and community members, as well as conducting landscape analysis and then developing skills in storytelling. So again, how do you tell the story of your solution? So through the externship, we're really getting people to understand major conservation issues, but then also think about what are some local issues in their community and what are some potential solutions that that they could propose, and then some go on to actually tackle those solutions.
What's the typical age range for an externship?
Yeah, so we have young people from 18 to 25, and it's a global program. So really, we've had a tremendous global interest. Mm-hmm. We've had over 200 applicants from over 200 countries. But really, the idea is the application is intentionally designed to really lower barriers. So we're really looking for young people who have interest in conservation and exploration, but you don't need formal training or, as Kate mentioned, to be enrolled in higher ed or anything like that.
So the externs, say, might identify an issue, an environmental or natural resource related issue in their community. Let's say if they live along the coast, it might be plastics in water or water pollution or something like that. They identify that, and then do they set up a task, or do they work with TNC and Nat Geo to help try to create some solutions to these problems?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that. So as Lena mentioned, they're convening online throughout, but exactly to your point, Chris, they're identifying this local issue. So they would identify that issue on the coast. They would be learning online through a virtual platform. Mm. They would be assigned expert mentors, which is a team comprised of a TNC expert and National Geographic Explorer. They'd be attending workshops on topics like storytelling, on research, on how to utilize data. And they would be combining that with their on-the-ground work and research. And that might be interviewing community members who are leading on this issue. It might be conducting their own scientific research. There are a lot of different ways that that takes shape. And from there, they're generating solutions. Yeah. All of that work then culminates in this creation of a digital ESRI story map that they'll present and share with their peers and their mentors at the end of the program, and ultimately with their community. And some of the topics, it really ranges. Lena mentioned we've had applicants from over 200 countries, and we've had tremendous interest. We've seen 40,000 applications for our 1,000 spots to date. And the topics are as varied as the geographies that are represented in the program. So some have focused on, one was on the journey of pharmaceutical pollution in a pill to pipe to Potomac to Bay piece. There was another focused on the Atlantic sturgeon and the population decrease that we're seeing and actions that can be taken to protect them before that's too late. Others have focused on Tasmanian giant freshwater crayfish, red tides in coastal waters of the Philippines, the politics of marine protected areas in Cyprus. So I could list nearly every country for you and many, many U.S. states, because we've had such geographic representation across the program. But it is a really exciting combination of this incredibly global cohort, these experts from around the world, and then these hyper, hyper local issues that young people are really getting to dig into.
Yeah, and I think that young people are carrying a lot of the weight that we have put on them environmentally, and you are seeing a lot of actions being taken by young people across the planet. But in working with these youth, these topics are sometimes heavy and hard to wrap your head around. What are you seeing in them? Are you seeing a lot of hope and hopefulness in this?
Yeah, I think one of the outputs of what Kate was describing of, you know, all these young people coming together and sharing solutions, it is actually just that, some amazing hope. Because as you see, so for example, we've got the two topics right now. We've got freshwater and community conservation, and marine and community conservation. So in a final presentation, you might have 20 presentations from all across the world of different ways that people are finding solutions. And so actually one of the things that we hear from our externs, there's actually a really great quote that I love about this global cohort, is that this is from our 2022 extern. My favorite experience throughout the program was interacting with externs from all around the world. I got to hear stories and experiences outside my own and found a glimmer of hope in that there are enthusiasts who are tirelessly give solutions to problems plaguing our community. So I think that there's just this element. We start with, you know, the obvious challenges with some of these conservation topics, but young people go very quickly when you talk about their communities and what they can do, which is hopeful for them. And actually, I think, Kate, probably really hopeful for us too.
Yes, definitely. It's incredibly inspiring to see what these young people are achieving through the externship. Those that successfully complete the externship can then go on to apply for and receive seed funding to implement these projects in their communities. Those have been tremendously exciting. So yeah, it is, it really gives you a lot of hope for the future. We know from so many different global studies how much climate change, biodiversity loss, nature, the environment is on the minds of young people. And we see this as a responsibility for both of our organizations to help them take action around that. And we're seeing that action happen in a really optimistic and hopeful way around the globe.
And I love to hear the word solutions, that they're coming up with solutions, because we can dish out a lot of problems and we can talk a lot about problems, but these young people perhaps have that energy and that forward thinking to want to bring forth those solutions.
And I would also add that what's really nice about the structure of this externship is how we are asking young people to do research. And oftentimes that research is actually going into their community, talking to, when we're talking about marine, who are the fisher folk in those community, or who are the elders in those communities? And so a lot of time, the solutions that they're coming up with both involve the community, but are built around this intergenerational knowledge that really adds this element of both history, but also with that young person's perspective.
We're speaking with Kate Ireland. She's the Director of Youth Engagement with the Nature Conservancy. And Lena Gomez. She is the Vice President of Strategic Innovation and Youth Initiatives with the National Geographic. And we're talking about externships, a collaborative program that the Nature Conservancy and National Geographic have put together. You say, Kate and Orlina, you said that this started back in 2021. Does each year take on different overarching topics? I think you kind of say you're focusing on marine conservation and freshwater conservation and programs. Have other years taken on other types of programs?
So to date, those have been our two topics. We are offering cohorts 3 times a year. We do spring, summer, and fall. Oh. Cohort is 100 young people large. And we've been able to gradually increase how many cohorts we're offering each year. We're really looking to continue to scale up the program. We have not been able to meet that global demand that we're seeing in terms of applicants. And in terms of topic areas, we're currently working on building out new topic areas now focused on data visualization and community conservation. We have a number of different topics that we want to continue to add in the future. We really hope as we continue to grow the program that we can continue to reach into the expertise that we have internally and also address a lot of the issues that we know are on the minds of young people so that they can continue to build those skill sets and work within their communities.
Who sifts through all those applications? Lena? Kate?
Well, we sift through quite a few,
yeah.
And actually we sift through quite a few on the seed funding front as well. Mm. So we actually have a third party implementation partner called Extern that helps sift through the thousands. Mm. But you know, it's funny. It's kind of a double edged sword because oftentimes we talk about that figure in terms of the application numbers, which that large of a number actually does point to how it's resonating with young people. It's a gap in the market, but also we feel sad that we aren't able to let more people, or that this is not something that we're actively working to scale this so that we can offer this experience to more young people. And what's actually really interesting is that one of the ways that we've been able to get so many young people to apply is actually through alumni recruitment. So it looks like something like 60% of our applications find out about the experience from our alumni. So again, these are kind of two data points that we are really both proud about, but also recognize we don't love having such a small acceptance rate.
Right.
Well, for Chris and I know that we love having National Geographic explorers on the show.
Yeah.
They're so interesting. Sure. They have so much to say. And obviously, bringing in this field experience is phenomenal to hear about and to learn more about. So I can only imagine that these young people are probably a little starry-eyed to be able to communicate with these explorers and learn more about what it's like in that vocation or in these fields, and to look forward to perhaps becoming that themselves one day.
Yeah, I think it's this great combination of National Geographic explorers, but also the experts from the Nature Conservancy. Mm-hmm. I think both have that generate the same amount of awe. We're actually really excited because we have actually seen the externship program as a great pipeline builder to the National Geographic Explorer program. So we've had Now, to date, 6 of our externs then go on to become young explorers. Mm. So it's actually quite now more accessible than ever to see the pathway from, you know, doing these projects as a part of our externship, building that knowledge, but then potentially then applying to become a National Geographic Explorer or apply for a fellowship or another leadership opportunity.
I'm curious if other nonprofit, say, environmental organizations, just scribbling down a few, like, you know, the National, the NRDC, Sierra Club, or maybe the Center for Biological Diversity, groups like that, if they've approached you or if they could, you know, establish an externship program like the two of you have.
We haven't had conversations with them to date. We've been really, we've been excited about what this partnership means and how we can offer this. And I think we're always open to continuing to explore ways we can build the program, the ways that we could build opportunities for our alumni. We now have 1,000 alum of the program in not even the first 3 years of offering it. And so we're continuing to look for different partners, different opportunities, different ways that we can build pathways for those that have gone through the program. But to our knowledge, we were the first to offer this externship opportunity. And we've been, as I said, very excited to see where it goes and are always eager to think about ways that we can continue to build it together with partners, but certainly in partnership with one another.
Well, absolutely. And both your organizations are leaders in this space. And so maybe other people can take a page from this book as they look into youth programs in their own communities to see how the youth can get involved. It's a great way to look up to how you're doing this and maybe use that as a model so that we can all be engaging the youth in our communities for the problems, because we all are facing, obviously, these problems in our community when it comes to environment. I know Chris and I, we built
no
a whole
shortage
show around
of
it.
Topics to discuss on a weekly basis, as you guys are probably aware of too.
Well, I'm curious from each of you, what are some of your favorite either recollection stories? I think it was Lena, you had the quote from one of the externs. What are some of the most positive stories that you have seen throughout this externship?
Yeah, there's one story that's as Kate mentioned, there are so many. So it's really tricky to pick one. But I was just talking to this former extern last week, so I'll pick that one. And she actually has a really interesting story. Her name is Betty Jete. She's from the Gambia, and she was actually part of our first cohort back in 2021. And she says that she was actually on her way to get her master's when visa delays postponed her master's a year. And what I love and makes me smile is that she says, actually, that delay in my master, that I'm so glad that visa was delayed because that actually allowed me to join the National Geographic and the Nature Conservancy's marine and community conservation externship. And she describes this as actually being quite pivotal in her journey as a part of the program. She actually went into her local community and started working on saltwater intrusion issues. Mm-hmm. And after about 4 months of collecting data, she actually developed the first ever, and so this is like, she's a young person, but she developed the first ever baseline data on both aquatic and soil salinity along the Bintang tributary.
Amazing.
And so that work that she did with externships, then she went on to plant 10,000 mangroves as part of her solution, and worked on this in her master's program. And actually just this summer is starting her PhD also on the topic at the University of Michigan. And she says that was all sparked through the externship. So, she is also a young explorer. So she is a great example of this journey and pathway that we're hoping to really impact with young people and help really introduce new concepts, really that conservation mindset, and really showcase how young people are really creating great solutions in their local communities.
Well, I'm glad to hear that she's going to the University of Michigan, and I hope to catch up with her someday. That is my home state, because from Michigan. So that is fantastic to hear. I love those stories, and I know she's going to make a big difference in our world. Kate, do you have one?
I have so many. I'm thinking of Morgan Foster, who participated in our very first cohort and has transitioned that experience into a full-time role at TNC working on impact finance. I'm thinking about Juan Francisco Sesquan, who is based in Colombia and utilized his seed funding to focus on sustainable fishing issues on Isla Fuerta and was able to help secure food security for 100 families within the region. Recently, Ali Mir from Pakistan focused on freshwater challenges in Thar, did a needs assessment, and based on that needs assessment, installed 18 hand pumps that were available for over 1,000 households within that local community, and is now working with community members to ensure that there's going to be long-term sustainability for that project. So, you know, we talked earlier about solutions and about hope, and that is what this generation is about. That's what this program is about. There's so many stories, and Lena and I don't even know all of them because there are 1,000 of them at this point, but it's really tremendous to see. And it does, as I said before, really fill me with hope.
We've got to wrap up. So when's the next round of applications, and where do people go? Where do kids go to sign up?
Yeah, so we're just in the midst of our summer cohort right now, and that will be wrapping up in the coming weeks, and we'll have our newest application live by the end of this month, and that will be for the fall cohort. And you can go to either organization's website and just type in externship, and it should pop right up for you, and you can read more about the program. You can read a few profiles on alum that have gone through the program, see some of our seed funding stories, and it'll link you directly to the application. And we encourage everybody to apply, and we are delighted to continue this partnership and keep building these opportunities for young people.
Well, we appreciate you coming on This Green Earth and talking about this, and we will put a link to the website up on our website so that people can go there. It's Kate Ireland, Director of Youth Engagement at the Nature Conservancy, and Lena Gomez, Vice President of Strategic Innovation and Youth Initiatives for National Geographic, who are joining us today. Thank you both so much.
Yeah, thank you, Lena.
Thank you.